I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. You couldn't really call me a stargazer. I don't think that's a fair description of me, but I do know a few constellations, and I'll occasionally point them out to my children in the night sky. Cassiopeia, Orion, Scorpius, Perseus, the Big and Little Dippers. One of my favorites to point out for years, because I think it's easy to spot, the Seven Sisters, or the Pleiades. And it came as quite a revelation to me one day when my wife, who happens to be a professor of Japanese language and literature, told me that Subaru, the car company, has a logo that is meant to depict this constellation. Now, Subaru is the star cluster that I had always called the Seven Sisters, and that was the big surprise. But when you start actually counting the stars in this group, the brightest ones maybe count five, perhaps. The tally can go up to nine or more, depending on which stars you want to let into this club. It's a very exclusive club. Well, I think, pretty much like other people, I get most excited about the starry firmament when I am lucky enough to see a meteor, a shooting star or a falling star, we used to call this phenomenon. And really fun one day was to see one just go shooting right across this constellation, Subaru, or the Pleiades. My very best attempts at stargazing are complicated, actually, by light pollution, but I am lucky where I live to be able to see more stars than other urbanites in the really big cities. Sometimes I have been out in the backcountry camping at night, and that experience is always revelatory. Not so much that the heavens are revealing any secrets to me, but my gazing at the stars, the Milky Way, for instance, surrounded by pine trees up at high elevation, I think it reveals something about myself to myself, more than any scientific understanding I actually gain. But maybe scientific understanding of the stars is not the only point of this experience. Now, is it? Here with us now to discuss the dynamic possibilities of our human stargazing ways and habits, our propensity and history with this activity, is journalist Jo Marchant. She's well known for her New York Times bestseller, which is titled Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. Marchant has delved deep into the nature of humanity and the situation of humans in nature and in the universe from the science of this mind-body connection and also the mysteries of past civilizations, the relevance and influence of the night sky in our lives, and other such matters. She's with us now to talk about her most recent book. It's titled The Human Cosmos, Civilization and the Stars. Jo Marchant, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Before we dive into some really specific stories that you offer in your latest book, I'm wondering if you can help us get ready for those by maybe divulging at least this much. Do you really think that there is any substantial continuity over the thousands of years of human star watching, any common denominator in this experience that we've had, we humans, of observing the night sky?
Yeah, great question. It's one of the things that fascinated me about this subject to begin with, actually, this idea that throughout the entire history of our species, we've all looked up at this incredible sky. We've all looked up at the same stars. And I do think that there are continuities, partly in terms of what that's meant for people's lives, that the information that you're getting from the stars is telling you when you are, where you are. So that's really practical information for navigation, timekeeping, timing of religious festivals. But I think more than anything, as you alluded to into your introduction, there's this spiritual aspect, this relationship that we have in the heavens. We are dwarfed by the heavens. We look up and feel the wonder when we see the stars. And that's something that also all of humanity has shared when you look at people's experiences of the stars and how the stars have influenced people's lives. But there, I think what's interesting is that we are in danger of becoming the first society not to have that. For lots of us now, light pollution means that we can't see a truly dark sky. A recent global survey showed that most of us in Europe and in the US can't actually see the Milky Way at all. Instead of thousands of stars in the dark sky, we now see only a few dozen in today's cities. So in writing the book, I was really interested in what have the stars meant to people through history? How have they inspired our civilization? But also, what does it mean now that we can't see them anymore?
I'm wondering if the experience over thousands of years for humans, I mean, there are big things that can make us feel small. You were talking about feeling dwarfed by all of this. I can see a big mountain, but then I can sometimes go up at least to the foot of the mountain or maybe even scale it, and it's kind of accessible. But the stars are in a different category of inaccessibility. I wonder if that factors into the way they have an influence over our feeling of being.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's the cosmos is the ultimate in terms of scale, in terms of something that dwarfs us, as I was saying. And I'm sure we're going to come back to this feeling of awe and wonder that the stars inspire in us. And we can feel that awe from lots of different things in our lives, including in nature and down on Earth. But that ultimate kind of quintessential source of that wonder is the stars. There's nothing more vast than the cosmos. But as you say as well, there's that inaccessibility, that feeling that this is a realm that's sort of different from the earthly realm. And pretty much every human society has seen the divine in the stars, that this is a different kind of, you know, perfect, eternal, celestial being. So again, that's fed into spiritual beliefs and philosophical beliefs and scientific beliefs all through human history.
Well, I promised I wanted you to share a few very specific stories. I know that you talk about the Pleiades, which I mentioned earlier, in terms of something in the Lascaux Cave in France. Tell us a little bit about that. Why did that strike you as it struck you as striking?
Yeah, so I wanted to tell the story of the stars as seen by humanity, I suppose. So starting from the beginning, let's go right back to the Paleolithic and see what the stars meant to people back then. And it was just a throwaway line in one of those history of astronomy books about a particular cave painting in Lascaux Cave in France, around 20,000 years old. There's this huge oryx bull, 5.5 meters across. And above its shoulder, it has this pattern of 6 dots. And it's quite a distinctive pattern in lines of 4 and 2. And there was just a throwaway line that, you know, this has been suggested to represent the Pleiades, the star cluster. And so in that first chapter, I decided to investigate that idea and look at the evidence that we can gain, because it's very hard to know what they really meant by these cave paintings. So what can we say about, were they representing the stars? Why would they have wanted to draw star maps? What makes this pattern of dots so interesting is that, as you alluded to as well, actually, you see this same very distinctive cluster of dots in art through history and around the planet. So Native American art, Siberian shaman's art, in the logo of Subaru, and all of these other clusters would look very similar to these dots in Lascaux Cave are representing the Pleiades. And what makes it even more interesting is this location above the shoulder of a bull, because in our modern constellation of Taurus, the Pleiades are right above the shoulder of the bull in the constellation Taurus. So it is a very striking similarity. And I think also you can look at more recent hunter-gatherer communities who have lifestyles or had lifestyles that might be similar to how people would have lived who were living at the time of the art that was painted in Lascaux Cave. And you invariably see that the cosmos, what's going on in the sky, although we're very separated from it now, was absolutely essential to every aspect of their lives, from timekeeping, navigation. Often people's houses are modelled on the cosmos. Their art involves cosmological themes, the spiritual beliefs and festivals. And this is because what was going on in the sky really did mirror and reflect what was going on in their lives on Earth. You get different constellations, for example, becoming visible at different times of year, and that correlates with the seasons. And so it's a very natural thing to start to link different stars with different seasons. And often different peoples would have calendars that are based around these risings and settings. So the Native American Blackfoot people, for example, had a calendar that was based around the life cycle of the bison, which they hunted. And this particularly was linked to, again, the Pleiades. When the Pleiades set, for example, that meant it was time to hunt. And so you could imagine something very similar going on with the people of the Paleolithic, where they're linking the visibility of the Pleiades with the Oryx bull. So it is possible that there could have been links there. And we know from analysis of myths that are still told today that there are stories about the stars still told around the planet today that have their origins in Paleolithic times. So I think what it's really telling you is that when our species first arose, people had a very holistic view of the cosmos. They didn't have such a separation between the sky and the earth. The changes that were happening in the sky were seen as absolutely entwined with the sort of natural changes, the seasonal changes that were happening down here on earth, and people's lives were bound up in that as well. So that was kind of the starting point, really. And from there, I wanted to go forwards to see, well, how did we get from there to this very objective scientific view of the cosmos that we have today?
Well, don't you think it's kind of exciting to contemplate the idea that, of course, Taurus is that word comes to us, you know, from the Greek-Roman mythologies. And then you start thinking, well, maybe clear over at the Lascaux Cave, you've also got this bull associated with the same star cluster, that maybe there's some common ancestral background way back in time where there's that continuity. I mean, that cluster with that kind of an animal, that just can't be coincidence.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, actually. I mean, it's really difficult to prove, but I do think that it's such a striking correlation that you think surely it can't be coincidence. And as I was saying, we do have evidence that other stories told about the stars. There's one called the Cosmic Hunt, for example, which is where an animal is being hunted and it sort of runs up into the sky and gets transformed into a constellation. That story, lots of different versions of that story with different hunters and different animals, are told in societies all around the planet. And researchers who tried to sort of draw a family tree of those different versions of the myth concluded that it would have first have been told in Paleolithic times. So that's evidence that these kinds of stories and connections can survive. These stories aren't just stories, they're cultural memories dating all the way back to the Paleolithic. So that is possible. And if you look at the constellation Taurus, like the earliest we know of that is that the Babylonians had that constellation. They didn't call it the same thing, but it was the association of the Pleiades with a great bull in heaven. And we don't know where it came from before that. So I think it's absolutely possible that these kinds of very fundamental associations could have continued all the way through until now.
But there's been something of a rupture where the fact that there's a constellation associated with a bull is something that somebody might learn today when they're maybe a school child saying, let's learn about the constellations and their names and how to identify them and spot them. But the actual stories themselves, they don't have any sway over us these days for us moderns, it seems.
Yeah, you're right. We're learning it almost as trivia as names. And yeah, those deep stories, but also those deep connections and associations with nature are lost. So if this idea about the sort of the oryx in the sky and the Pleiades being associated with the life cycle of the oryx bull is right, then this would have been really fundamental for people's lives. This was an animal that they hunted, and these stars, the visibility of these stars in the sky, would have been marking those really key moments in the year. One astronomer calculated that back when that bull was painted, the visibility of the Pleiades would have marked the mating season of the Oryx bull. So this really kind of fundamental, important moment that are being marked by these stars and then being represented by these constellations in the sky. And we have completely lost that. And yes, I think there's that broader point that we've lost our personal connection with the stars more broadly. Like for most people, what's going on with the stars and also the moon, the sun, the planet, isn't of direct personal importance to us anymore. And we don't see our personal experience of the stars as necessarily telling us important information anymore, whereas it would have done absolutely in the ancient past. So now we get our information and our understanding from scientific studies, sort of objective, evidence-based measurements and data. And, you know, I love science. I'm a huge fan of science. I think that scientific knowledge is incredibly elegant, powerful, and important. But at the same time, I can't help feeling that perhaps we've lost something that matters. You know, we've in building that scientific understanding, we've at every stage, and this is kind of the trajectory that I look at through the book, we've sidelined that subjective experience of the sky and what the stars sort of mean to us. And so we don't look to the stars anymore. Even scientists today don't actually look through telescopes. This is all from electronic detectors and computerized analysis. So we've got the data, we've got that nailed, but our actual personal looking to the sky and how do we feel when we see the stars, I think that is something that we've lost.
Well, it's not just us humans who have this habit of trying to read the stars. Apparently, oysters and crabs try to do it too, and we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. But first, I've got a question. I don't quite know how to ask this, but as long as I've kind of zeroed in on this one constellation, the Seven Sisters, and then the bull and those stars over the shoulder of the animal, is it possible, do you suppose, that in ancient times – this gestalt of the bull was as significant as the gestalt provided by the heavens. I'm wondering if the wonder and the awe was not just that thinking about the story of a bull helps you to remember where those stars are, but those stars also point in the direction of the bull being something of significance.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think you're right that people in the past wouldn't have separated these things out in the same way that we do today. And they lived through stories and images and characters and beliefs, and saw these stories, these animals, and in other societies, gods and different creatures in the sky. And you wouldn't have been able to separate the two. So I think the significance of all of those things would have been absolutely entwined.
Jo Marchant is with us. She's a journalist and author of The Human Cosmos, Civilization and the Stars. We're going to take a short break and come back, talk about those oysters and crabs and maybe even sprouting potatoes, all sorts of organic material connected with the cycles of the seasons and the stars. We'll talk about it. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure to have Jo Marchant with us, a best-selling writer, a journalist. She's author of The Human Cosmos, Civilization and the Stars. Earlier, a book of hers, bestseller, New York Times bestseller, titled Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. Jo, when it comes to the sidereal heavens, the starry firmament, and natural connections of organisms here on Earth to the stars. It's not just us humans. And you talk about different plants and animals as somehow being in sync with the cycles of the stars or maybe the moon. Why is that of such importance when we think about us humans?
Yeah, so through much of the book, I'm looking at a cultural history. So how the stars, the moon, the sun, the planets have been important for our politics, for our art, for philosophy, for science, for religion. But I also wanted to look at our biology. So how humans, but also lots of other animals and all different creatures have evolved for their biology to be, as you say, in sync with the heavens. Like life is cyclical, and all aspects of our biology, from cell division to kidney function to our sleep patterns, are regulated by celestial cycles. And that's true for all life. And the sun is a sort of kind of obvious example. That research is really well established. There's a really good understanding now of how we have circadian rhythms, these 24-hour rhythms that are timed with sunlight, literally built into our DNA, and they are regulating all aspects of our biology. But what I also wanted to look at was how there's now a growing understanding of lunar cycles as well. So lots of different organisms, and including us, have got cycles that are regulated by the moon. Research is best in some of the marine species, where we know that hundreds of genes, their activity is regulated according to the phase of the moon. And that's something that has been suggested in the past. You mentioned oysters. There was a experiment back in the 1950s by a US biologist where he took oysters from the sea off the east coast of the US, and he took them on the train to Illinois, where he was working and put them in a sealed lab. So they were in kind of jars of water, but completely sealed off from the outside world. So no cues in terms of temperature or light or water currents. And he knew that these oysters open and close to feed in time with the tides, which in turn are linked with the lunar day. And he wanted to know if they would keep opening and closing, if they would keep that sort of that tidal rhythm. And what happened was actually they kept the rhythm, but the timing of it shifted by a few hours as if they'd gone into a different time zone. And he realized that they had switched the timing perfectly to match the moon in Illinois. If there had been sea in Illinois, they were now feeding in time with what the tides would have been in Illinois. So it was suggesting that even though they were completely cut off from the outside world, somehow they were sensing the moon. And he became convinced that all creatures are sort of somehow sensing these celestial signals, that our biology is being regulated by not just the sun, but lunar cycles. And he was really dismissed at the time, not taken seriously. But recently there's been a lot of work looking at lunar cycles and realizing that actually this has been understudied, and there are lots of marine and tidal creatures that are absolutely running in time with the moon, but also on land as well. You've got Serengeti wildebeest that time their conception according to the phases of the moon, from the, birds called whippoorwills. There are insects, there are plants that are fertilized by the moonlight at full moon. And then in humans as well, there's quite a lot of interesting evidence now that women's menstrual cycles really can be entrained by moonlight, for example, and that phase of the moon affects sleep patterns, which in turn can affect psychiatric disorders. So I think it's this sort of something that hasn't been taken that seriously by science, but actually now we're realizing that we are much more plugged into these cosmic cycles than we realized.
So if I come across an old farmer's almanac that talks about planting certain seeds in sync with cycles of the moon, maybe I should not be so quick to discount that as old folklore?
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say that, you know, all folklore, all old folklore is definitely true, but it does seem that there's often a sort of germ of truth in a lot of these old tales. So fishermen in the Mediterranean used to talk about shellfish, for example, as sort of becoming full or empty in time with the phases of the moon. And that was something that really wasn't taken very seriously until, I think, in the 1920s, there was a biologist that went to check and realized that their gonads were sort of growing and shrinking. Their external fertilization was absolutely regulated by the phases of the moon. So there are lots of things, lots of links, lots of knowledge, I think, that does contain a germ of truth. And the interesting thing is with sort of mythical tales and folklore around the moon, it varies in lots of different societies. The moon is seen in very different ways, but there are some common threads. And one is around fertility, with the moon is regulating reproduction and fertility. And that goes all the way back to Paleolithic times. And also with mental health, with the moon and madness, and, you know, werewolves and the full moon making people mad and that kind of thing. And those are the two things that we are now finding with the research actually may have some truth to them, through sleep patterns and through reproductive cycles. And I just wanted to mention one other thing about the moon, actually, which is that a lot of the lunar cycles are regulated by changes in light levels, so moonlight, phase of the moon. But there was a really fascinating study a couple of years ago looking at patients with bipolar disorder, where they have these sudden mood switches between high and low mood, which is known to be affected by changes in sleep patterns. And the patients over many years kept track of the timing of their sleep and their mood changes. And the researchers found that this was actually being driven by cycles of the moon, but not the phase of the moon, nothing to do with the amount of moonlight. This was to do with tidal cycles, with the position of the moon in the sky, which is suggesting that that would either have to be through some kind of subtle gravitational effect, or perhaps through sensing changes in the Earth's magnetic field, because the moon creates very subtle tidal effects that can affect the strength of the magnetic field. You kind of get this sort of ripple effect with the lunar day. And so that really has researchers just in the last year or two very, very interested in what's happening there. It may be that we have a subtle magnetic sense that we're not aware of, and there is some other research supporting that idea. So it's early days for a lot of this research, but a lot of really interesting threads suggesting that there is a much deeper connection there with the moon.
And when you say a deeper connection, I sense that you're saying that we might postulate that even if our cultural memory is more alienated from the old stories and the old understanding of the cycles, maybe biologically, physiologically, there's something that still remembers that.
Yeah, exactly. So we can separate ourselves culturally from what's going on in the sky. But from a biological point of view, we're going to pay the price for that. And we know that that's true with the sun. There's lots of evidence now showing that if we separate ourselves from those the daily cycles of the sun, if we're working in dim offices during the day or we're looking at bright screens at night, that throws off our circadian rhythms. And that has having health effects from things like causing things like insomnia and depression, all the way through to heart problems and even cancer. Shift work has been named as a possible carcinogen. So it matters. We might think that with our technology these days, we can live with this freedom. We don't need to worry about the cycles of the sun. But from a biological point of view, that isn't true. And it may be that from a more sort of subtle perspective, that is also true for the moon. It's interesting that several decades ago, there were trials showing links between lunar phase and women's menstrual cycles, timing of childbirth, for example. But that link has kind of weakened or disappeared in more recent studies. And that caused some scientists to say, well, that link was never there in the first place. But others say, well, that is what you'd expect, because we're not actually exposed to natural patterns of moonlight anymore. And we don't actually know what the consequences of that are on things like sleep patterns, mental health, reproduction, and fertility. So I think that that is an area where it would be great to have some more research trying to pin that down. So it's just one of several examples I give in the book of where it's great that we have this technology that allows us to separate ourselves from the sky. We no longer need to look at the stars to know what time it is or where we are, or for entertainment or for spiritual beliefs or any of these things. But there are downsides to that separation as well.
And to come to some kind of conclusion on this particular point you're making about the responsiveness to the influence of the heavens on our lives, it's not just non-human organisms like oysters you talk about. You also get into plants. You talk about sprouting potatoes. You talk about the mimosa plant, the sensitive plant. Were you surprised to find out that so many plants are responsive to these cycles?
I think I was surprised to the extent of it. Like, it's fairly well known that plants have these 24-hour cycles. So certainly the circadian rhythms, they'll open and close their leaves at certain times of the day and night. Different flowers will open at different times. I think it was the biologist Linnaeus centuries ago who suggested the idea of a clock made of different kinds of flower, where each hour you could have a different flower that flowered at that particular time of day, and so you'll be able to tell the time. So this is known to be part of the living world. Everything is cyclical. But I think I was surprised certainly by the effects of the moon, actually, because I'd always assumed that maybe the moon was just to do with things like coral that will all spawn at exactly the same time, and they use lunar phases to do that. But to find that, there is a type of cactus that only flowers at the full moon, for example, or there's another plant, ephedra, which releases these drops of liquid at the full moon, which sort of glitter in the moonlight and attract insects for fertilization. So just the extent of the moon, what it seems to be doing is helping different animals and plants, different organisms, to coordinate their activities in time. So whether that's different individuals of the same species for fertilization or different species that need to cooperate, it's kind of this global coordinating, synchronizing force that's giving these time signals on top of the time signals that we're getting from the sun. And just the complexity and the subtlety of that, I just really love. And it did really surprise me, yes.
I want to be a little bit more explicit now on this thing you've already mentioned, which is the sense that we're missing out on stuff, we moderns, that we're disconnected, that we don't have the same opportunities perhaps of observation to see the stars, to see the moon, to sense what's happening in these cycles. And then you point to a fellow named Chris Hadfield, an astronaut. And let's talk a little bit more about his experience and fold that into all of this.
Yeah, so Chris Hadfield is a Canadian astronaut. And in the book, I mention a story that he tells about his first spacewalk and how he went up to the space station. He's, hard-headed, technically trained. He's been working for years to get to this point with all the technical knowledge and the practical skills. And he steps out of the space station. He's completely ready for his mission and for what he needs to do. And then he sees the beauty of the Earth. And he says that he was attacked by raw beauty, is the phrase that he used. He said it stops your thought. It's stupefying. And he said that he talks about, in one direction, there's the velvet bucket of the universe, these stars stretching on forever. And then you've got on the other side, the Earth, this amazing revolving kaleidoscope of color with the planet turning underneath him. And that it taught him just that experience of seeing all of that, taught him something that all the sort of lectures and books and training couldn't teach him, which he said was the power of the presence of the world as told to me by my ability to see it. And I think that's just a really nice description of why it's important that it was him, a person, a conscious human being up there to experience that, that we're not machines, that just sending machines up into space to do work isn't the same. And this is a phenomenon that's called the overview effect that is really common among astronauts. You get a lot of astronauts going up into space and again, they're very highly technically trained, they've got their jobs to do, but when they come back, they're not talking about technical knowledge or scientific insights that they've gained. They come back talking about the beauty and the fragility of the Earth, how important it is that we look after the Earth as this fragile haven of life, how important it is that we treat each other better and look after each other better. So it completely changes people's perspective. And often astronauts come back and their lives are changed. They become vocal advocates for peace or for environmental causes, for example. And psychologists call the overview effect a really powerful example of the emotion of awe, which they define as the feeling that we get when we're confronted by something vast, something that dwarfs us, something that's beyond our capacity to comprehend it. And there's a lot of work showing that, you don't need to actually go up into space to experience awe. That's a very powerful example, but we can experience awe back on Earth as well, and particularly when we look up to the stars, as we were talking about before. And there's a lot of research now showing that this feeling of awe when we look to the stars has profound effect on us. It's really important. It makes people more creative, more curious, happier, less stressed even weeks later. People feel more connected. They make more ethical decisions afterwards. They're more likely to make sacrifices to help other people. People say that they care less about money and more about the planet. So you've got all of these influences on personal well-being, but also on people's perspective, and they start to see themselves as part of a bigger picture. And I think that's just really, really profound and really important that all researchers warn that in modern society we're focused on small screens all the time, we're not being confronted by these vast horizons of nature, and they're calling that awe deprivation. We're not getting the awe that we need, and they warn that that's making society more selfish and more narcissistic. So I think kind of at this time in our history more than ever, we really, really need that view of the stars.
Who are these people who are making these findings or making these assertions? Are they psychologists? Are they, I have no idea who they are. The scholars?
Psychologists and neuroscientists mostly. So this work has been pioneered particularly by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley. So there's a psychologist there called Dacher Keltner, is one of the pioneers of this. But there are different groups around the world. It's just the last sort of 10 to 15 years, really, when awe has been studied, and particularly the last few years where the psychological studies, so you're exposing people to awe, and that's often showing people the stars, but some of the studies also will have used tall trees, dinosaur skeletons, sort of natural sort of vistas, so different ways of triggering awe in people and then asking them about how they feel, or doing different measurements, measuring physiological markers of stress, that kind of thing. But now we also have neuroscience studies, so looking at what's actually happening in people's brains when they experience awe. And there was an interesting recent study showing that sort of patterns of brain activity that are associated with our sense of self are actually dampened or diminished when people experience awe. And that fits with other studies actually showing that after feeling awe, people sign their name smaller, they estimate their own physical size is smaller. So that's feeding into an idea that awe triggers a kind of small self, it's been termed. So rather than seeing ourselves as all important, our daily concerns as just being super urgent and important, that's kind of being dialed down. I mean, instead, people are seeing themselves in relation to a bigger picture. And that's explaining some of the changes in perspective that researchers are seeing in these studies.
Well, the most telling question I could pose to you now would be that after you've done all of this investigation into this whole issue of the human connection with the stars, with the heavens, and humans trying to find meaning or even living, maybe not even with full consciousness, but in their bodies being connected to the stars rather than with their minds, or a mix of both. All this work you've done to pursue this question, has it changed your want? Has it changed your habit? Has it changed your daily walk in life in any way that you are more given towards moments of observation?
It really has, actually. I wasn't expecting it to necessarily. I started off just wanting to write a history of how people have looked to the stars. But for me, it became much more questions about what makes us human, our relationship with reality. So the two main things I would say are that I have become much more aware of what's going on above my head. I live in London where there is terrible light pollution, and I had always assumed that there wasn't much point in looking up because there's not much you can see. But I've realized that even here, I can become much more connected with the patterns of the moon, for example. I notice the phases of the moon now. I see the moon during the day. You kind of just make that relationship with what's happening and that time period. But also some of the brighter stars, like I will look for Sirius now with the kids, and we've realized that I'd read once that it sparkles all the colors of the rainbow, and we now know that it really does, and it's something that really inspires them as well. We've had gatherings with our neighbors looking through telescopes, looking at the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter, and that's been something that's really brought people together in our community. So just, it's almost like you have friends. I feel like my environment means more now. So just knowing almost like those individuals in the sky, but also knowing the stories that people have told about those different stars and what they've meant to people through history also then makes me feel more connected, not just with my environment, but with other people as well around the planet and through history. And especially, you know, through the year we've had with the lockdown, certainly here we've been confined to our homes for last periods of the last year. So we haven't been able to really explore, you know, beyond our neighborhood, but we can explore the sky, and that has been something that's been really important to me and to my family this year. And the other thing is more to do with how I see reality, because I was kind of brought up with a very scientific perspective that there's an objective external reality out there, and we sort of move through that, and you're almost like a passive observer, like looking through a window at events that happen. And now I'm much more focused on personal experience. So I think I would see my own reality much more in terms of my experience of it and how we create every moment that we live sort of anew and afresh. So that's a kind of broader thing that goes beyond just simply the stars. And so, yeah, both of those things have really helped my quality of life, I think, since looking into this whole story.
So is it fair to say that with this new perspective, where you're not looking through the window as a detached observer, where you're more personalizing these experiences, is it fair to say that you now are more susceptible to the experience of awe?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about intent and attention, that you find what you look for, and you can go through everyday life sort of, you know, wrapped up in particular concerns or worries and not seeing what's around you, or you can go through life seeing awe in everything and in even the smallest things. You know, we can see awe in the stars, but if you're in that frame of mind, you can see awe in the tiniest sort of leaf on a plant or in a small act of kindness that someone does. So yeah, I think absolutely, once you start looking for it, you do see that everywhere.
I'm just going to push this issue one little bit further, which is you genuinely could look me in the eye. This is radio and I'm not seeing you right now, but you could look me in the eye and say that in something as small as a leaf, you perhaps have accessed the same kind of awe that you described in that experience of the astronaut from Canada, Chris Hadfield.
Well, I think, I mean, you have different levels of it. I think the cosmos and the stars seems to be particularly powerful at just forcing people into what we'd almost call a transcendent experience, that loss of self. It's a very extreme experience that stops your thoughts, stops your language, can create quite immediate and profound changes in people's perspective that will then last. And so I wouldn't say that I would look at a leaf and have that extreme experience. But you can have small drops of awe as well through your life, I think. So we don't have to only wait for those really dramatic experiences. But, you know, you look at a leaf and you think about what that represents, and you think about this web of life that all comes from this single origin that we're all part of, and how, you know, we're all, there's so much that we all share. And this is where awe, you know, can be found in scientific understanding as well. I don't want to imply that I think that science is completely dry and only about data and there's no wonder to be found there. If you have a scientific understanding of what's going on inside a leaf and the way that, you know, a single leaf is capturing energy from the sun, for example, and converting that into food that feeds the rest of us, and that just that, yeah, that connection and this web of life that we're all part of, I think there's an awful lot of awe and almost transcendence to be found there, but it's perhaps in smaller drops rather than one enormous tidal wave.
Jo Marchant, it's been a delight to get to know you and to speak with you. Thank you so much for this time.
Thank you for having me.
Jo Marchant with us. She's a journalist well known for her New York Times bestseller titled Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. And her most recent book that we've been talking about today is titled The Human Cosmos, Civilization and the Stars. Stargazing is easy, I suppose, as long as you can find a dark spot on a clear night. Moon gazing, also pretty simple. But Earth gazing? It takes an awful lot of money, technology, and risk to get yourself in the position to enjoy an Earthrise. We'll talk about the first Earthrise photo, an image that changed the world, captured by Apollo 8 in 1968. That's when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. One of the greatest wonders of our age is the chance that many of us humans have to step outside our world and view ourselves from the skies and then from space. And arguably no moment in human history has better captured the emotions of that perspective than the fabled Earthrise photo captured on color film in 1968 by the astronauts aboard Apollo 8. To celebrate that moment, I had a chance to speak with Emmanuel Vaughn Lee. He's an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and director of the documentary Earthrise, The Image That Shared Our World. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
There was never a real plan from NASA to take images of the Earth from space. This is something you hear all the astronauts share in the film, is that they had no directive to take pictures of the Earth. to take pictures of the Earthrise. They were there to test the viability of a future moon landing, to see if they could actually survive a voyage to the moon. Could they orbit the moon? Could they take some images of the surface of the moon that could be future landing sites? But there was never any directive, any instruction from NASA to say, hey, turn the camera around, take a picture of Earth because we want to see what we look like. You know, as Jim Lovell says in the film, we were all on the Earth, so we thought we knew about the Earth, which to me was such a telling statement, you know, the hubris that we had back then in 68, that we just thought we knew everything about where we were and who we were because we were on the Earth. And that's, again, I think what made this image so profound is it just captured in a single frame exactly who we are. So, it was not a planned image in any way. And if you listen to the audio recording of that moment, because NASA had tape rolling the entire time during the mission, you hear them literally go, oh my gosh, look at that photo. We got to get that. Get me the color film quick. Oh, you know, they're just in the moment, you know, struck by this vision of awe and grandeur and doing their best to capture it. So to me, the fact that it was an accident just underscored the importance of telling this story, because it shows how easy it is to just have blinders on, looking forward motion. We're going to do the next best thing. We're gonna conquer the moon. We're going to conquer Mars. We're going to just keep on going forward, that kind of drive that has become almost our mantra as humanity, and that we forget to look back and we forget to pay attention to the ground beneath our feet. And so, you know, 50 years later, one of my hopes for sharing this film is that it reminds us the importance of slowing down and remembering where we've come from and who we are. And that means looking back to this iconic moment.
You know, I kind of wonder if we had just sent some sort of remote-controlled orbiter out there, no humans on board, if we had just sent something up there where it could have captured the very same image, you know, I wonder if it would have been as profound as kind of living by proxy through those astronauts and experiencing the shock, the amazement in that moment through those voices that are recorded as they themselves realize for the first time that they're seeing something utterly spectacular. You know what I'm saying? If it were unmanned, have you ever thought about that?
I've thought about that a lot. And, you know, we see so many images, you know, beamed down from the International Space Station now, which are taken digitally without a human being behind them. And for me, at least, they don't have the same kind of connection as when I see an astronaut on the space station who's taken that image purposefully, framing something with an emotional connection to the subject matter. And I think that's part of why we connect to this image. And, of course, because we know a human being took it. And it was a human being who was looking down above, and we could relate to that human being. We can't relate to a machine. Or, you know, that's the thing. When we see an image that was taken by a human being that was there, we can feel and connect to that experience because we know somebody else took it. I don't think that's just an isolated experience related to the Earth, or I think it's something that makes photography so powerful, is that, you know, you could have unmanned drone footage of a war zone, but you can have a human capturing that image, and it's going to be a very different experience because there's an act of witnessing that is part of that. And I think we as human beings, we can relate to that act of witnessing, of observing something and participating in something. And that's what makes these moments so powerful when we get to participate vicariously or by a proxy through someone like Bill Anders.
There is a story here of tension and exposure to risk that's really understated, I think, in the documentary that you make, because we get to hear them talk about that smallness. Emmanuel, if you would just address this smallness issue, because I think that's like the complication of the plot that makes you feel sick in your stomach while you're watching the documentary.
Yeah, it's something they all described in their own way in the interviews, is just how small the Earth really was when you got out there at 240,000 miles. And then, of course, how small it made them feel. That moment of seeing how small and then, of course, how fragile the Earth is just shifted them. And that's what I think shifted us as well, because we saw it as so small. But at the same time, it's still home.
Well, this is moving in the direction of that famous piece by Archibald MacLeish that appeared, was it in the New York Times, 1968?
The 25th. He wrote, the day after their broadcast, he wrote this op-ed piece or little piece inspired by the broadcast that included this poem, Riders on the Earth.
There is a universal something that just hits you, no matter what age you are, I think, and it lets you know that this photograph, Earthrise, has political and environmental and even existential implications. I don't know how anybody could miss the point of the photo. Do you?
No, I really don't. You know, that's what makes it so surprising, that it's lost some of its gravitas for people, perhaps because it's just been so, you know, ubiquitous that people will go, oh, yeah, it's that photograph, but they forget the story that goes with it.
Yeah. Have you been going the rounds trying to revive interest in the photo? I mean, clearly that's what the documentary is about. But, I mean, have you been proactively, like, going the circuit and giving lectures?
No. The film has been, you know, screening at festivals and events, and I go and share the film and talk about, you know, the film with audiences. But, no, I actually haven't said, you know, we need to, you know, to get this photograph out there more and more. I'm more interested in what the story can remind in us, which is not just about the photograph, which is what this photograph prompted in us to get, you know, back then. You know, can we return to that feeling of love and awe and grandeur and wonder? You know, I feel like we live in a wonder-deprived world. You know, yes, there's wondrous images on our Instagram feeds at all times, but they don't seem to evoke wonder in the way that this photo did. And can we somehow connect to that sense of wonder and awe and find a way to make it stick? That's the question I have. I don't have an answer, but it's the question I have. And can that story kind of evoke something in us?
I like that phrase, to make it stick, that you just used, to make the sense of awe and wonder stick. Are you good at it sometimes? Not all the time, but are you good at it sometimes?
On good days.
On good days.
I'd be a lot better. You know, I think it's one of the things I think it's challenging right now is we have so many distractions that take us away of just sitting in wonder. You know, 50 years ago, there were a billion people watching and listening to this moment. You know, there aren't too many times nowadays we have a billion people doing anything at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think to have a billion people share in wonder or awe, that's one way to make it stick. But I think, you know, we just have to find ways in our own lives, given the distractions that we're overloaded with, to kind of carve out space to be in a space of remembrance and awe and wonder for what the photo represents, which is home. And again, go back to what I said earlier, I really feel that one of the messages, if you will, the film has is that Earth is home, both in the macro sense as a planet from 240,000 miles away, but also in a micro sense with, you know, the home that we have, whatever that is. It's an apartment, it's a house, but it's also what's around it. It's the people around it. It's the Earth around it. It's the gardens that we can care for. And can we keep on expanding that sense of home?
Emmanuel Von Lee is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and director of the documentary Earthrise, The Image That Shared Our World.